Wildfires in the Amazon are burning out of control. That's not just a local problem, it is global.
All the human beings, all the people from the world, all the governments have to look for this situation and try to help us.
We speak with a firefighter in Brazil and also get an aerial view of the Amazon fires. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, reports that Israel has carried out airstrikes in Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq.
If the Israelis have done this, and again, that still remains a big if, they have raised the level of tension and potentially put the region closer to a war footing than it was a month and a half ago.
And we'll meet Fyodor.
Привет. Это Skybot F-850.
The first Russian robot in space. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is not one wildfire in Brazil. Tens of thousands of wildfires are burning in the Amazon region. The clouds of smoke they're sending into the atmosphere are so large they can be seen from outer space. But a closer look from a helicopter just above the tree line might be even more troubling. My BBC colleague Will Grant took a tour above parts of the Amazon rainforest that are going up in flames.
It is extremely upsetting, extremely disturbing to see this kind of devastation unfolding in front of you.
I asked Will what he's been seeing and hearing over the past few days in Rondônia State, which has been severely hit by the wildfires.
It was pretty breathtaking, Marco. I mean, just to see such environmental devastation unfolding right in front of you, hectares after hectares of forest just going up in smoke, absolutely no sign of anyone doing anything to prevent it. Obviously, quite remote regions. But yeah, it is unfolding on a huge scale. And of course, even in the state capital of Porto Velho, quite often you would have a blanket of smoke and dust and ash sort of covering the sky, just hazy skies the entire time. It's an environmental catastrophe taking place with very, very little sign, certainly that I saw, of any concerted effort going on to prevent it.
And why is that, Will? Is it because officials are just sitting on their hands, or is it because they don't have the resources to fight these fires?
It's a combination of factors. President Bolsonaro absolutely intends and has made it policy to open up the Amazon. In terms of this balance that has always been attempted to be struck by successive governments in Brazil, balancing the opening up and the development of the Amazon resource versus the protection of it for the good of the entire world, President Bolsonaro falls very hard on the side of developing it. Opening up protected lands to mining, opening up the Amazon to farming, industrial farming, logging. Now, in terms of this particular crisis, I think you are right to say there is an element of people sitting on their hands, whether or not it's bureaucracy, a lack of equipment. That's all hard to know for sure. But what is certainly the case is that the Bolsonaro government has cut funding for some key agencies devoted to protecting the Amazon region in recent months.
Did you speak with any people in Rondônia State? Are they talking about Bolsonaro, or are they just too busy fleeing the fires with their lives?
I didn't speak to people who are right in the flames, as it were. You know, there are obviously villages and individual groups of people who are much closer than others. But certainly in the state capital, obviously people think about Jair Bolsonaro. He's one of those personalities, much like Donald Trump, who completely dominates the political discourse. You can't get away from him even if you wanted to. So yes, they do think about these things. But at the same time, most people are just focusing on getting by. It's important to note that in Rondônia, for example, he's actually very popular. He won with over 70% of the vote. That said, that popularity is plummeting. And I think what concerns a lot of people is just the tone that the president is taking and the damage that he's potentially doing to Brazil's standing around the world.
So, Will, you spoke about some of the mining policies, the farming policies. Has there been any pushback on the lack of strategy for controlling these fires from any of those industries, or like agribusiness, which also is deeply invested in the Amazon?
I think, to be perfectly honest, a lot of those businesses are keen to see these fires rage. Ultimately, the forest for them is in the way. So it's a gradual process. First, you deforest the most valuable timber. Then the forest is much weakened and setting fires becomes far, far easier. Where the forest is extremely dense and verdant and green, you can barely light a match in the humidity, let alone set the thing on fire. And that is happening, it appears, from a variety of sources. Yes, small-scale subsistence farmers who've been doing slash and burn for decades in rural Brazil and around Latin America. Also, cattlemen cutting down the trees and using fire as a way to clear land for their cattle. And also, potentially, big industry. It's hard to prove, but given the nature of the administration, what I would say is I think whoever is setting these fires certainly feels emboldened enough to do so. Now, we've got to be careful. We're not suggesting in any way that this is Bolsonaro's policy to set fire to the Amazon. But certainly the lack of regard, I would say, that he has shown for environmental protection is something that's characterized his few months in office so far. And people are furious about it. And I think that there is definitely a knock-on effect for Brazilian business, for Brazilian economy, for Brazilian exports more widely.
That's the BBC's Will Grant in Brazil. I also had the chance today to speak with someone on the ground battling the fires in the Amazon. Major Commander Colonel Paulo Barroso has been leading operations in Cuiabá, the capital of the central Brazilian state of Mato Grosso.
We have a lot of fires, but unfortunately, we don't have enough teams to fight all the forest fires because, unfortunately, we don't have the adequate structure.
So when you say you don't have the adequate structure, do you mean you don't have enough firefighters or you don't have enough resources?
No, we have people. We have people, but we don't have the structure to go to the field. We have 141 cities and we have fire department in 22 cities. The place we work, the cities we work, we can control most of the fires. But in other cities, we don't have team to fight the fires, we can't control them because we are not there.
So that means that you are extinguishing some fires, but other fires continue to grow.
Yeah, because we have a large territory. We have more than 903,000 kilometer squares to attend. And the fires happen almost at the same time in a difficult environment because we have a few roads. We don't have airships and even the basic equipment to distribute to our people to go and fight the forest fire. So we need all the fire departments, not only the Mato Grosso State Military Fire Department, but all the fire departments of Amazon area. All of us need equipment. We need airships. We need a structure.
Well, President Jair Bolsonaro was offered assistance by the G7, and he did not readily accept it. I mean, wouldn't that have helped control these wildfires?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why he did this, but we are receiving the federal support by the Army and the Air Force and another agencies. We are receiving this support. So probably he is in condition to support the state, and he's doing this. But it's more than this. I'm worried about what it will happen in the future, next year, and the years ahead. We have to plan to structure a forest fire protection system in Amazon forest. But now we are fighting, we are doing what we can with what we have.
Major Commander Colonel Paulo Barroso, leading the Operation Cuiabá in the Brazilian state of Mato Grosso. Thank you for your time.
Okay, bye.
The big worry about those fires in the Amazon is that they could cause irreversible damage to our warming climate. But if you're paying attention to what's happening in the far north above the Arctic Circle, there are dramatic signs of climate change happening already. Lapland is often described as Europe's last great wilderness. The region stretches right across the top of the globe through Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. It's the native home of the Sami. They're the only indigenous people in Europe who still live off the land. But warming temperatures are transforming the Arctic region faster than almost any other part of the planet, and that's threatening the traditional livelihood of the Sami. My BBC colleague Erica Benke went to Finnish Lapland for this report.
I came to this forest in Inari, the capital of Sami heartland. I've come here to meet Anna Morottaja, who's checking up on her family's reindeer.
Usually winter came in the end of October, and now it can be in December. During the winter, there can be really warm periods that get the snow to melt. When the snow melts, then the basic best food of reindeer, this reindeer moss, freezes. The reindeer can't dig it. They can't even smell it through the ice. That's starvation then. And starvation means that the reindeer herder has to take extra food. And of course, then it affects the income of reindeer herder.
But that's not the only pressure. As temperatures rise and the sea ice melts, there's now an opportunity for a shipping route to open through the Arctic Ocean. There's also a plan to build a railway across northern Lapland to move goods from Central Europe all the way to the Norwegian port of Kirkenes on the Arctic Ocean. The railway would also help to exploit the region's natural resources. There's copper, nickel, cobalt and zinc here. But the Sami parliament is fiercely opposed to these plans. Tiina Sanila Aikio is their president. I spoke to her on the bank of the fast-flowing Utu River, next to her office.
We live from the nature, and it will cut the reindeer grazing areas into two. There will be more forest logging, for example. It will be transporting oil and gas products from Norway and Russia. It will bring the mining industry to the Sami homeland area in Finland. It's the worst night where we are facing at the moment, concrete one. Of course, climate change is another one, but it's not as concrete than the Arctic Railway.
Supporters insist that it will boost Lapland's economy. The Finnish government says a final decision hasn't been made about the Arctic Railway or its route. But Heini Veslin, who teaches traditional Sami handicrafts in Sevettijärvi near the Russian border, fears being forced to move.
Those plans I have seen, so it seems like it would go straight through our house. And my opinion is that it will be genocide.
Strong words, but the plans are a painful reminder of the past. Heini is a Skald Sami. Many of her people were forced to leave their ancestral lands in Russia and resettle in Finland.
All these kind of mining plans are our big nightmare here. Yeah, we are very afraid of those. That was why Skald Samis have to move after Second World War. Everything is only measured by money. But how can you put a price tag for a culture?
A sentiment echoed by Anne Marit Labba, a young Sami woman I met on the border with Sweden.
There are some people that say mines bring jobs and wealth, and they want to build mines here because they think it's empty. These fells are empty, there's nothing there. But they forget that we are there. Our reindeer are there. What do you actually need in life? You can't eat gold. There is something more important than mines.
Development, clashing with the traditional way of life and the environment. Increasingly seen the world over. Some claim they can coexist, but many Sami people disagree.
Erika Benke with the BBC reporting from far northern Finland. Up next, the French president is trying to create a diplomatic opening for the U.S. and Iran. But when it comes to calming those tensions, who will move first?
It's risky. But as I've said, considering the stakes, I think it's worth trying.
French diplomacy in the Middle East? That's just ahead. Don't go away. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Emmanuel Macron is playing the middleman, and he's got his work cut out for him. The French president worked to set up a meeting between President Trump and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. At the close of the G7 summit on Monday, Macron sounded hopeful that it might happen. Trump also said he would be willing to meet Iran's president if the conditions were right. But it did not take long for Rouhani to say no, he would not meet with Trump unless the U.S. lifts sanctions on Iran first. So where does that leave France and other U.S. allies still in the Iran nuclear deal? Gérard Ahault is a veteran French diplomat. He served as France's ambassador to Israel, the UN, and most recently to the U.S. from 2014 until earlier this year. Ambassador, thanks for being here. Emmanuel Macron seems heavily invested in brokering this meeting between Trump and Rouhani. Why do you think that is?
You know, actually, President Macron has been on the phone for several weeks calling Rouhani and calling President Trump because we have this extreme tension in the Gulf, which means that any incident could lead to a military confrontation. But at the same time, Macron is convinced that Trump doesn't want war. So he has been really trying to mediate for some time. And whether he will succeed or not, nobody knows. But I think that it's worth taking the risk.
So what are the chances, do you think, Ambassador, that Trump lifts sanctions in order to sit down with Rouhani?
You know, we were on the French side. The idea was not lifting the sanctions, but in a sense, having a waiver or suspending them for 1 month, 2 months or 3 months. And that on the American side sounded really conceivable. Donald Trump was not saying no. So it would be a sort of de-escalation leading to a negotiation with the Iranians. The problem that you have on the Iranian side, in Iran, you have different circles of power. There is a deep mistrust towards Trump. I wouldn't bet everything I own on the success of President Macron. It's risky. But as I've said, considering the stakes, I think it's worth trying.
And you don't think John Bolton and Mike Pompeo in Trump's ear would keep some kind of waiver of those sanctions away for a month? Would that stop it?
The problem, I think you are emphasizing a genuine point. You have a president who doesn't want war and who is ready to negotiate with the devil if necessary, as he has shown with North Korea. But his entourage, and especially John Bolton, is much more on the regime change line. You know, with this administration, you have to be very careful because there is only one person who decides, and this person is Donald Trump. That's the reason why Macron is talking directly to Trump.
So let's imagine that the circumstances are right for a meeting between Trump and Rouhani. What is the best outcome, do you think, from a meeting like that? And what would be the worst outcome?
You know, the best outcome would be, first, a de-escalation of the tension in the Gulf. You know, you had these attacks against the tankers. You had the deployment of Western ships to protect the tankers. Again, there are radicals on both sides who are looking for actually creating an incident. So it will be already a first important step. And of course, this de-escalation leading to the opening of a negotiation between the Americans and the Iranians.
And what would be the worst outcome?
Again, the worst outcome is really a meeting, nothing happens, everybody is going back home, and again, an incident on the ground.
Gérard Ahault, veteran French diplomat and the former ambassador to the United States until early this year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The standoff between the U.S. and Iran is only part of the story in the Middle East. In recent days, the governments of Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq have all accused Israel of carrying out airstrikes on their territories. The targets appeared to be pro-Iranian militias. This puts Iraq in an especially tough spot. The government in Baghdad is a U.S. partner, and Israel is a U.S. ally. To make sense of what's going on here, we turn to Douglas Ollivant. He served as director for Iraq in the National Security Councils of George W. Bush and Barack Obama after two tours in Iraq as an Army officer. He's now with the Washington think tank New America. Douglas, let's clarify, first of all, what has actually happened in Iraq over the past month?
Well, in the past month, we've had four major Hashid or PMU or Shia militia. Those are all more or less synonymous terms. Four of their installations, the ammo dumps on them have blown up. Now, whether this is because of Israeli airstrikes or Israeli espionage or accidental, the ammunition just blowing up, that's totally unclear. So we don't really know what the facts on the ground are. What we do know is the subjective reality. As you said, the Iraqi government and certainly the Iraqi street believes that the Israelis attacked them, and that's the reality we're now dealing with.
So I gather you were just in Baghdad last month and you're in daily touch with friends and colleagues in your consulting firm over there. What is the word on the Iraqi street?
For Iraqis who lean more towards the Iranian side, this is totally expected. In their minds, this is what the Israelis do. For the Iraqis who are more American-leaning, who are more Western-leaning, more moderate, there's a sense of betrayal.
Whatever happened, I mean, it puts the government in Baghdad in a tough spot. How is it responding?
Well, the government is in a tough spot. It has restricted all air movement, so all air power, all air medevac of the entire coalition there, stating that none of those airplanes can fly without explicit Iraqi permission.
What's to stop those Shia militias from retaliating against U.S. targets inside Iraq?
Absolutely nothing. We have to hope cooler heads prevail.
So if this airstrike makes life more difficult for the U.S. in Iraq, why would Israel do it?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, any outside power, there's one of two things going on, whether we were talking about the Israelis doing a strike or the Iranians doing a strike or the Turks doing a strike, means one of two things. Either there's a legitimate security interest that they have, that there were some weapons here that the Israelis thought were going to change the security calculus, and therefore they attacked them. Or there was a domestic political aspect to this. They needed to appear politically tough for their own domestic political purposes.
You're referring to the upcoming election in Israel.
Well, in this specific case, you can't ignore that that's there.
And why would the U.S. allow it?
That's a great question. And I think there are many parts of the U.S. government that were blindsided by this and are now trying to figure out what's going on. So that's a great question, but I don't have a good answer for it.
So again, if this is Israel who threw the first punch, I mean, they seem to have thrown down a gauntlet attacking pro-Iranian forces across the region in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon. Where do you see this going?
This could be the start of a new wave of instability, of low-level conflict, of even higher-level conflict in the region. That's not to say that's certain to happen, but if the Israelis have done this, and again, that still remains a big if, then they have raised the level of tension and potentially put the region closer to a war footing than it was a month and a half ago.
Douglas Ollivant, senior fellow at New America and former director for Iraq at the National Security Council. Really appreciate your time today. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to The World. Another storm is heading toward Puerto Rico, where memories of Hurricane Maria are still vivid.
I think a lot of people are having flashbacks. It's almost like some sort of a traumatic syndrome, you know, and it's not only you.
I'm Marco Werman. How people in Puerto Rico are preparing, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. An asylum seeker tells a judge that if he's returned home, he will be killed. Then he's deported to his home country in Central America, and he is killed. That's what immigration lawyer Matt Cameron told us happened to one of his own clients. Cameron is the co-director of the Golden Stairs Immigration Center in Boston. He told us how he found out the news.
I was meeting yesterday with someone who had been in custody with him for a couple of months. They knew each other pretty well, and he'd gotten into the family, and he shared the news with me just in passing as we were finishing up the meeting, and I was stunned. I didn't even know. I think he thought that I knew, and it's been sitting with me since then.
And do you trust that source, and how certain are you that that source has accurate information?
I'm absolutely certain. I mean, it's very specifically, I know that they were in close proximity together in custody. They were close friends. And, you know, this man would know if anyone would know outside the family.
I mean, just an awful confirmation. I mean, given his worries, your own worries about his future back home, how did that make you feel when you heard the news?
To be honest, I'm sure this has probably happened before in cases that we couldn't win. You know, it's devastating. I've always thought of this as death penalty work. But this is the first time I've had it confirmed. And it was really on my mind yesterday. It really sat with me.
There are a lot of details about your client's story that you don't want to give because they could divulge certain information that would expose others close to him and put them at risk. But what does that simple reality tell us about the level of violence that people are fleeing from?
I can tell you firsthand, just from hearing these stories and having been to the border and talked to them myself, that this is real. This is happening. And we bear a responsibility for this as a nation.
Yeah. Explain what you mean.
Well, we're talking about people who are essentially several generations later, even one or two generations later, coming out of circumstances that we created in Central America. And I think it's very important for Americans to understand that because we have a short collective memory sometimes. But the torture, genocide, the widespread violence, a lot of this is at our door. We trained and funded these wars. We destabilized these countries. We've economically exploited them for many years. And, you know, these people are not showing up out of nowhere. These claims and these situations are very real, and they're very much our responsibility in many ways. It's so hard for us to pull back from our perspective and to think about ourselves as Americans, but we have to take responsibility for the things we do abroad. I think many people understand Iraq, Afghanistan, these are recent enough that we know that we owe some responsibility to these countries now, and I would submit it's the same thing.
Matt, how does this tragic case compare with other cases you've been seeing?
Unfortunately, the facts in this case are very similar to a lot of the cases that we work with, where there have been people in the home country who have already been killed and where there's a very real threat of death to the person that we're working with. And, you know, the problem is that this administration in particular has launched a war on asylum, a very direct war on the concept of asylum, of asylum law, and is doing everything it can to circumscribe that law as narrowly as it can and to keep these people out.
So as you know, the president and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Attorney General Barr, they have all made the point that immigrants are being coached. They're often making up stories. Isn't it possible asylum seekers are stretching the truth to be able to stay in the U.S.?
I have to tell you, I haven't met any. You know, I always sit down with people and start taking their stories, and I ask them directly, what happened? Why are you here? And I let them talk. And that's what we work from. I don't give them other details. I don't make suggestions. I just let them talk. We take down their story, and we prepare them to testify. And I know that my colleagues do the same, and it's just deeply offensive to me to have Jeff Sessions in particular last year suggesting that these are just all made-up claims that attorneys are somehow profiting from.
Do you ever worry that some of the truth may be stretched or embellished?
I can't remember turning anybody away, but I would turn someone away if I thought that this was actually not a true story.
Is the immigration policy in any way deterring people from continuing to come to the U.S.-Mexico border?
I really don't think people are thinking about the latest decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals when they're setting out from Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador. They're setting out with the clothes on their backs, often with 24 or 48 hours notice from the people who are about to kill them. And all they're thinking about is what any of us would be thinking about, just getting their families out of there.
Matt Cameron is an immigration lawyer here in Boston and co-director of the Golden Stairs Immigration Center. Thank you for being with us and explaining this, Matt.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate it.
Puerto Rico this week is preparing for another big storm and the heavy rains and flash flooding that could come with it. Tropical Storm Dorian is bringing heavy winds and rainfall tonight and into tomorrow morning. This comes as Puerto Rico is still not fully recovered from Hurricane Maria 2 years ago. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports on how people on the island are preparing for Dorian.
Grisel Gonzalez spent part of Hurricane Maria huddled in the safety of her bathtub. When she was stocking up on water over the weekend, the long lines brought those memories flooding back to her and her 11-year-old son.
We were in the Costco, and then he observed people with their cars filled with water. So he looks at me, and he said, "Mom, you didn't tell me there was a hurricane coming." And he's like, "You need to tell me. I need to prepare."
Preparing is just what the island is doing. Gonzalez is a scientist with the National Forest Service. Even before a storm watch was announced yesterday afternoon, she and her colleagues moved official vehicles away from trees that could fall on them and filled up on diesel.
We have all our generators full. We are filling all our gas tanks and leaving the cars in position, like ready to move. It's a reaction to Maria. and we know how important it is.
The Puerto Rican government says the island is more prepared this time around. The residents don't seem willing to bank on that.
We know the infrastructure is weak, and even if we don't get a major hurricane, we are expecting that the little wind that we might get us without power or water.
The winds from this storm are expected to be only a fraction of the intensity of Maria's, but that hasn't stopped people from testing out their backup generators and making a run on grocery stores for supplies.
I think people are more ready right now.
Edgardo Gonzalez lives in San Juan, where he runs a conservation nonprofit. Since Maria, he's been helping local communities build backup water systems and preserve food.
A lot of people are taking more precautions. I think although we can expect power failures and problems with water, I think everybody is more prepared.
Gonzalez bought a water filter and two rain barrels after Maria. They stand ready to catch the 2 to 8 inches of rain expected from this storm. He also set up a solar-powered battery backup system that he bought instead of a generator after Maria.
I'm like everybody testing that is everything is working fine and that it's collecting power right now from the sun. And I took out the solar panels just to be ready just if I need it.
The government says it has far more backup electrical equipment than it did before Maria. But some streetlights in the metropolitan region are still out 2 years after that storm. And up to 30,000 homes still have tarps for roofs. Many Puerto Ricans, like college student Luis Aviles, have lost faith in their government. Aviles plans to leave the island after the storm dies down, if it's really bad, stay with his brother in Florida.
I just bought a plane ticket for Friday for Orlando, just in case.
Aviles weathered Hurricane Maria in his mother's apartment 2 years ago. He had to haul water and food up 9 flights of stairs each day after the power went out. The wall-to-wall media coverage of this storm is reminding him of those difficult days.
You put the radio on and all you hear is about the upcoming storm. I don't want to live what happened with Maria again.
He's suffering from what Grisel Gonzalez sees as an island-wide reaction to what happened 2 years ago.
I think a lot of people are having flashbacks. It's almost like some sort of a traumatic syndrome, you know, and it's not only you. But we are trying to keep it cool. And I think if you focus on the mission, this is something that really pulled us through last time.
The storm's exact trajectory and intensity are still uncertain, and Puerto Ricans are watching the forecast closely. The storm center is expected to pass near or just south of the island on Wednesday before moving toward the Dominican Republic on Thursday. For The World, Carolyn Beeler.
The historic Johnson & Johnson court ruling yesterday continues to reverberate for people who've been touched by opiate addiction and for people who've relied on opiate medication for their pain. Johnson & Johnson was fined over $500 million, the judge saying the company, quote, caused an opioid crisis that's evidenced by increased rates of addiction. Johnson & Johnson says it plans to appeal. But how uniquely American is a case like this? The World's Alana Gordon has been looking into how opiate prescription use here compares to other places. Alana, marketing played a big role in the Johnson & Johnson allegations. How does the marketing of prescription opioids work in other places around the globe?
So let's start in the UK. The UK, as an example, is very different. There's a national health system there, and so the incentives and the pressures on doctors to prescribe or misprescribe opioids isn't there. I talked to John Collins. He directs the International Drug Policy Unit at the London School of Economics.
These kind of practices would be regulated out of existence in somewhere like Europe. It's just not acceptable for this kind of predatory behavior around these kind of dangerous substances.
And again, the practices he's talking about there include aggressive marketing to doctors and patients, like the overselling of the benefits, the underselling of the potential harms.
Yeah, and that's not acceptable here in the U.S. either. I mean, just look at these lawsuits. What makes the U.K. different?
Regulations are one thing. And there's also something else really big that's different.
And what's that?
Ads. So, you know, you see advertisements for different drugs on TV.
All the time.
And that is not something that the UK allows.
So, Alana, give us an example of where this issue of opioids looks totally different than it does here in the US.
So I want to take you to a couple countries in Africa for a moment. Many places like Burkina Faso and Mali, patients there don't have access to opioids, even if they might need it.
They're afraid of the word morphine, they're afraid of the word opioids, mainly because of what's coming out of America.
So that is Dr. Anne Merriman. She founded Hospice Africa. She's based in Uganda, and she says countries regulate opioids, but many aren't allowing it. Plus, she says the incentives there for drug companies to import them just aren't there.
Most African countries that we deal with are economically poor, and they cannot afford to buy from the big companies. And this is why before we came in, there was only three countries with palliative care in Africa, because they couldn't control pain, because they couldn't afford tablets and the stuff produced by companies.
And that's meant that a lot of people are in pain with conditions like cancer. Hmm. When she got to Uganda in the 90s, there was no such care, and she saw lots of people in that situation. Merriman's group has worked with governments now to actually make a type of morphine. So she actually supplies it for all of Uganda.
What is our own, like in the West, our own ideas of pain and how to treat it? What does it all have to do with these prescribing patterns around the globe?
The culture of pain in a society makes a big difference. So if you think about the U.S. as an example, the culture really shifted in the 90s. To a culture of more prescribing. There was a big palliative care movement, a pain movement that grew to better treat pain, to not see loved ones in such excruciating pain from things like cancer and dying. And drug companies jumped on board with that too. So that also increased pressure on hospitals to treat pain. You know, pain is subjective.
Right.
If you've ever gone to a doctor's office and they're like, how much pain are you in? On a scale of 1 to 10?
Yeah. What do you even say?
I mean, 12.
Yeah, it might be really bad. Like, do you have a 12 on the chart? So, Ilana, let's hit up one more location, India. India is seen as a huge potential market for prescription opiate manufacturers. And there's some big reporting out this week from Kaiser Health News on this. What puts India in the sights of drug manufacturers?
Well, India is a place where that culture of pain has changed. And there's been a growth in pain centers. I talked to a public health advocate, Dr. Bobby John, who's in New Delhi, and he says that the newer opioids are able to circumvent national regulations because they're made differently.
The number of brands and manufacturers for pain-relieving medicines, mostly on the opioid side, they number into multiples of pages.
He says more drug companies are looking to India to prescribe medicines for pain. They want a stake in it. And to John, like others, he says it's a fine balance because you're trying to recognize the importance that people not suffer from excruciating pain. But he is very concerned about the country developing an excessive supply, essentially facing a situation that the U.S. is in now.
Wow. The World's Ilana Gordon. Great to get the global context on the Johnson & Johnson case. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's an international Twitter snafu, a faux pas of diplomatic proportions. Let's face it, if you want to go into politics these days, your Twitter game best be on point. That's thanks in part to Donald Trump.
I've never seen a thin person drinking Diet Coke.
Here are some classic Trump tweets sung by Josh Groban on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Sorry, losers and haters, but my IQ is one of the highest, and you all know it.
Trump might be an extreme example, but he's surely not the only politician who knows the power of the tweet. But the thing is, Twitter is not for beginners. Things can go so wrong so fast. Case in point, Kashmir. Yesterday, a Pakistani politician named Rehman Malik retweeted a comment about human rights violations in Kashmir. Malik wanted to tag the UN in his tweet. Instead, he accidentally tagged UNO. That would be UNO, the card game. And if you think the Twitter sphere is just going to let that go, you don't know the Twitter sphere. One user said Pokemon Go might give better guidance on the situation in Kashmir. Someone else suggested that Pakistan might want to apply for a loan from Monopoly. In the end, I think we can all learn a valuable lesson here. Twitter is best left, in my judgment, to rating dog pics. Across the United States right now, many young people are heading off to college, moving out of their parents' homes for the first time. What could possibly go wrong? In Sweden, the average age of those leaving home is 18 or 19, the youngest in Europe. And there are worries that loneliness and mental health troubles are confronting some young Swedes. One possible solution is to ditch the idea of living alone and give communal living a try. The BBC's Maddie Savage reports from Stockholm.
This is Verlingby, almost at the end of the metro line. It's a purpose-built suburb packed with high-rise apartments. I'm on my way to meet a 21-year-old renter who's been living alone here for 2 years.
So, jag heter Ida Stahlberg.
So my name is Ida Stahlberg. I'd always wanted to move out and I'd always felt ready. At first it was really nice, but after a few weeks I started to feel lonely. When I came home it was quiet and empty and there was nothing, only myself.
Bara mig själv.
Ida pays her rent and bills by working as a security guard. Her studio flat's around 30 square meters in size. It's sparsely decorated, just a wire butterfly hanging on the wall and photos of her family who live on the other side of the city.
It became easy to start having a bad image of myself or destructive thoughts, and not to mention the stress of earning a living and handling money. And also stuff like when the washing up liquid runs out and the toilet paper doesn't refill itself.
More than half of all Swedish households are made up of people living alone, the highest proportion in the EU. This is partly down to rent controls and cities made up of compact apartments rather than townhouses that lend themselves to sharing with friends. But the norm of moving out after high school has persisted, despite a housing shortage that's led to a pricey subletting market in recent years.
We have a tradition in Sweden, and our society is built on certain values that we should all manage ourselves. We should not be depending on each other as much as in other countries.
That's Karin Schultz from the mental health charity Mind.
Loneliness among young people is much higher than expected. One would think that elderly people are much more alone than younger, but it's relatively high among young people as well. For a young person, it's of course wonderful to feel independent and be able to take care of yourself, but for some, they're not really ready for it.
Sociologists say there's a lack of hard data to back up the idea young Swedes experience more social isolation than other Europeans. But loneliness is a hot topic. The country's biggest newspaper recently suggested there's an epidemic among young people. The Red Cross has stepped up resources for tackling the issue. And entrepreneurs in Stockholm's strong startup scene have been coming up with solutions. So my next stop is one of a growing number of co-living spaces in Stockholm. High-spec, grown-up versions of student dormitories for anything from 12 to 50 people that cost around the same as a solo apartment. Similar projects have already taken off in cities including San Francisco, London and Berlin. I'm here to meet one of the tenants, Michelle Axelsson.
It's a way of meeting new people and you can have dinner parties and, I mean, you can choose if you want to be alone or if you want to be with someone.
Do you think there might be any bigger benefits for society?
Places like this is a great solution for especially Swedes who are being quite, you know, not so outgoing as maybe the rest of the world.
The company behind the space wants to create tens of thousands of co-living units within a decade. And research suggests there is a market in the Swedish capital. A recent study found almost half of 18 to 35-year-olds would be interested in sharing with friends or others outside their immediate family. But critics argue Sweden's individualistic culture is too deep-rooted for co-living to become mainstream. Back in Verlingby, even Ida Stahlberg says she wouldn't give up her solo lifestyle.
Although it is tough sometimes and I feel lonely, I still think of it as something really positive. I've learned a lot, I make decisions myself, I can manage alone and I have power over my own life.
Her words recall an old Swedish proverb, ensam är stark, alone is strong.
That's the BBC's Maddie Savage. A Russian rocket took off from Kazakhstan a few days ago, and the only passenger aboard is making history.
Привет. Это Skybot F-850.
The Russian crew member's name is Fyodor. He is Russia's first humanoid sent into space. And today he successfully docked the International Space Station.
Liftoff of the unpiloted Soyuz MS-14 spacecraft.
NASA there translating some of the Russian commentary on the liftoff. Fyodor, the Russian robot, stands at 5'9" and weighs over 350 pounds. He's got all sorts of skills. He can drive a jeep, fire a gun, and do push-ups. Fyodor even channeled his inner cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin, before taking off recently, uttering the famous Russian phrase, "Poyekhali," or "Let's go." Fyodor's on Twitter, too. His first tweet from far above Earth was, "Sorry for the delay, got stuck in traffic, am ready to carry on with work." It took a couple of tries to dock at the ISS. Fyodor got it done after a failed attempt over the weekend. Actually, it wasn't really the robot who was in charge, as Vitaly Shevchenko from the BBC points out.
There was so much enthusiasm that some media incorrectly reported that Fyodor was actually piloting the spacecraft.
Shevchenko says Russian media oversold Fyodor's image to the point it's become misleading.
It appears that Fyodor does most of these things when he's controlled by a human. And even the designer says that he has no learning ability. And this means that there's no artificial intelligence and therefore he's not autonomous. And because of this, there's a lot of mockery online and people are saying on social networks that it's just an expensive gimmick and part of state propaganda.
After all, Shevchenko says, Russia's high-tech sector isn't exactly the most cutting edge right now.
Projects such as Fyodor are subject to Western sanctions as well. And critics say that no amount of window dressing and media fanfare will be able to disguise the fact that things are made worse by corruption and embezzlement.
Whatever his political background, Fyodor is not the first humanoid to travel to space. NASA sent up Robonaut 2, a humanoid developed with General Motors back in 2012. Both the American robot and Fyodor were developed to carry out high-risk tasks in space, jobs that can be dangerous for any human astronauts, no matter what countries they're from. Rocket from Herbie for Fyodor. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios, I'm Marco Werman. Poyekhali, I'm out of here. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.